This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G. here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening?
Good. There's a storm in my area, so I don't have my landline. It's knocked out, so we just have to make do with the cell phone. So we'll do the best we can.
Sounds great from this side. So we'll hopefully transmit through the internet okay for our listeners who listen who don't listen live. But we're going to power through,
okay.
And I think it should be just fine.
All right.
So today on the show is titled Anger in Relationships, Falling in Love with a Monk, and a question about food cravings.
All right.
So I've sent Dr. Lyle, I sent you an article recently that we're going to talk about on the show. And this article discusses this. It's a psychologist who is an immigration psychologist. His name is Arash Emamzadeh.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote an article called The Cycle of Anger in Relationships. And it sounds like he's trying to piece together what the research says in the Journal of Research in Personality. There's an article by a couple of authors that piece together the review of all the literature, and they're trying to figure out where anger comes from and where the cyclical model of anger comes from in relationships. And a couple of highlights from this article is that they say, quote, the current research proposed a cyclical model of anger involving both intrapersonal and interpersonal mechanisms that outlines how anger becomes mutual and self-perpetuating between intimate partners. Now, this particular author says, similar to characterizations of gratitude as both sensitive to others' prosocial behavior and a cause of one's own prosocial behavior, they're proposing that anger arises partner's negative treatment, and anger motivates one's own negative behaviors towards partners. And through these processes, anger is readily transmitted across partners and elicits responses that may perpetuate anger. So the article actually proposes that on days when people feel particularly angry towards their romantic partners, they tend to engage in more destructive behaviors towards their partners. So I consider myself a layman when it comes to psychology, but that doesn't make sense to me about days when people feel particularly angry. Now, I've certainly had days when I wake up on the wrong side of the bed, but I can't imagine this is any scientific discovery of any magnitude. But I will leave that to you in just a second. So as we go further on this.
Come on, I want to talk now.
Okay.
No, just go ahead. Go ahead, Nate.
But so we look at this article, and they have a couple of figures of it's essentially these boxes with arrows. It's kind of like you're evaluate your worst case scenario, and you drop down the box. But this one is daily anger, then daily destructive behavior, then daily perception of destructive behavior, then your other person's daily anger. And so what sounds like they're trying to stumble upon is what we've heard on the show before, maybe about a year or two ago, which is the vicious cycle and the virtuous cycle. So, I might be making a stretch here, but this is what I think about this article is that it's, as I sent you and as I posted on the Facebook group, they are starting to catch on. It's interesting that they're not quite there yet, but we wanted to hear your take on this article, Dr. Lyle.
Yeah. I glanced at this thing today, and my colleagues are morons. What can I say? I'm surrounded. All right. this is a it's a kind of interesting. I think it's Journal and Research and Personality. I think it's a legitimate journal and legitimate scientists trying to figure this out. This is where you go. This is what happens to science when you're not hooked in a consilient fashion to the theory of evolution. You sort of look at things and just describe them and you build a model, but none of this is hooked into the understanding motivation. And obviously anger is a very sophisticated mechanism that has been built by evolution for a specific purpose that statistically increases the likelihood of survival and reproduction. Obviously. Okay. But only obvious to people that have either read Richard Dawkins or listened to this broadcast. Clearly not the authors, not the psychologists, the academics that did this thing. So let's look at this. What anger is it's a signaling mechanism. And it's a signaling device that tells the person on the other side of it that it's directed towards. Anger is a threat. They're just calling it destructive behavior. It's not destructive behavior. It's a threat. Okay? It's just like any other behavior. It's designed to statistically optimize the likelihood of gene survival. So what it's doing here is it's actually attempting to influence the receiver on the other side of the communication. And it's not meaning to be destructive. It's threatening them. It's saying, you're treating me unfairly, and if you continue to do that, there's going to be consequences. Now, they're talking about, oh, well, then that causes anger back. Really? That's not typically what's going to happen. What's typically going to happen is it's going to cause guilt. So where is that in the model? Not in the little boxes I saw that you sent me. The purpose of anger is to get concessions out of people on the other side, and it activates the guilt mechanism. So it doesn't always. It might, though. So very often when, like, if you take two intimate partners, I mean, it would help if somebody, and this was a clinician, because the truth of the matter is very often if you've got some angry, pain in the ass, you know, disagreeable partner, the person on the other side spends half their time feeling guilty because the anger mechanism keeps activating guilt mechanisms because the guilt is a mechanism that says, oh, my God, you think I've treated you unfairly. Boy, I sure don't want to get kicked out of this coalition. Sorry. What can I do to make up for it? That's what's on the other side. Okay. So now it is true that sometimes when someone is if someone sends an anger signal, the person on the other side essentially has a couple of choices. I mean, they're not choosing, but they're making inferences. And the inference that they might make is, oh, my God, you're angry because, you know, something that I did that was bad, i.e. that was unfair in the relationship, let me scan my memory. Is there anything? Maybe there is, okay? And so now maybe I feel guilty, and now I'm starting to make submissive gestures or conciliatory gestures, i.e. signal guilt, so that I can mollify the anger and reduce the likelihood of whatever the threats are that are on the other side of that anger. On the other hand, I might say, I am not guilty of anything. You're being a shithead. Okay? In other words, I might look at it and say, no, I'm not guilty of anything. And you are threatening me for no good reason. And I know what you're threatening me for, and you're out of line. And now the person that gets the anger directed towards them, they themselves get angry and send a signal back. Okay? Now this is what these guys are talking about, because they're like, gee, there's a mutual destructive thing. Yeah, okay. Let's look at what's really happening. What this is a negotiation. And at the root of it, there's a conflict of interest that is either a really bad conflict of interest that needs to be rooted out and exposed, or these people are going to be perpetually not very happy. Or it turns out that there's a misunderstanding that needs to be rooted out and shown the light of day. So I saw what they said. They said, oh, be kind of nice. Think happier thoughts about when the person's angry and interpret it some other way. They had the most ludicrous notions about what you're supposed to do to fix this. What you're supposed to do to fix this is use what I call crystal clear. So if someone's angry, it gets to be very interesting, because their feeling that you've been unfair with them may be fairly complicated. And they may have some really pressing issues in their mind about what it is that they're pissed off about. But it also could have a lot of ancillary processes that are going on that are causing them not to be direct with you. Okay, that there's a complicated swirl of insecurity, anger, resentment, and all kinds of stuff that's happening. So if we're going to, these guys are going to just like, I don't know, just keep swirling this thing around indefinitely and try to be a little nicer, good luck to you. No, if we want to get to the root of this thing, we're going to use crystal clear. And crystal clear is you need to start asking questions. And you need to essentially be determined that you're going to keep asking these questions until you get it super clear. So the way you're going to do it is you're going to have the guts to tell your partner, listen, I can tell you're not happy with me, and I'm not sure why. So what I want to do is I want to find out and see if we can figure it out. Because I don't like it. I feel irritated myself, but I want to hear where you're at. So can you tell me what's going on with you? No, says the son of a bitch. Okay, so I go, okay. Could you guess? No. Okay. So do you want to just be silent about it and just protest indefinitely until you're ready to talk? No. It's like, okay, well, you'll talk when you'll talk, and, you know, the door's open. Oh, well, I can't really help you, you know, and I'm not going to bow down and kiss your feet if you don't tell me what's going on. So that's that. You threaten them back. But we're doing it very openly. Okay, now, so how is it really going to go? Listen, I can tell you're not happy with me, and I got like 7 reasons why that could be, and I'm not sure what it is. But I want to know, because I don't like this feeling. Okay, I want us to feel good. So can you tell me, can you talk to me and tell me what's going on? What are some of the things that you're upset about? What are some things I did? And shut up, and you let them talk, okay? And then they talk some more, and you say, you don't defend yourself. No, there's no defense. No defense. No, no lawyers in here. No arguing, nothing. Your job is to keep asking, okay? Keep telling me more about this, more about that. Tell me more. Let me see if I understand. And all you get to do is you get to ask questions, and then you get to summarize what it is that they're saying. So what you're saying is that every time we go out somewhere, you catch me looking at the waitress, and that makes you upset, okay? And then what you blah blah blah. You feed it back until they can give you a look in the eye, and they can say, yeah, that's it. That's what I feel. Okay. Now you have it crystal clear. You've done a full assessment of actually what's going on inside that person's head, if they will allow you. Okay? They may not. Okay? They may not be willing to talk, and that's because they may be insecure about some things. They don't want to walk into the space where they believe that the relationship has intractable conflicts of interest, and they're not ready to actually face it. Okay? But if we don't think that the relationship has conflicts of interest that are insurmountable, then we definitely want to be quietly and patiently tenacious about crystal clear. And then once we've heard it all, then we can say, okay, let me see if I can respond to some of this. And we're looking for where there's been any misunderstandings, exaggerations, where there's been some baggage that's been brought to the fore because there's past hurts that haven't been resolved and negotiated. But the spirit of this thing is, hey, you know, we're not one person, and we're not one entity. We're going to have some conflicts of interest. And, if you're angry, I want to know why. I want to understand it and then see if we can make things fair, because I want to be fair. And fair is the central word that is where it is that we're aiming. Okay? So if we do this, this is how we unwind this. it doesn't hurt to be add a little bit more finesse if you want to be really good. And that is, you, before you begin Crystal Clear, you feed back to your partner a whole bunch of things about what it, why it is that you found, find them so valuable and attractive. This is flood the circuit. Okay? So you say, listen, I, you know, for 3 days you've been giving me the silent treatment and you've been irritated with me, and I'm not sure why. Like, I could speculate, you know, I could guess about five different things maybe you could be mad about, but I don't know why it is. And I feel vaguely guilty, and I also feel vaguely irritated because I don't know whether it's fair. I don't know what you're up to. But I do know that, you know, I'm here for a reason, because you're the most important person in my life. And I, you know, I value you tremendously. I love this about you. I love that about you, this, that, and the other. Okay? If you want to get really fancy, you use the technique that's on my website. I talk about it, attribute anecdote. So you give them the attribute, i.e., you're so beautiful. I just love how this or that looks about you. So the anecdote, attribute, and then the anecdote is the details around it. You know, I just appreciate your honesty. I can remember the time when. So now we flood the person's circuit a little bit, and we can even say we're doing it. Listen, you need your circuit flooded. Okay? Let me tell you all the things I admire about you, and you flood them. Okay? And then you say, I really need to know what's going on. I need to understand this because I just want to be fair, and I just want to hear your side of the story, and I want to get it. Okay? If you use that kind of a process, then one of two things happen. You resolve the conflict probably pretty well, pretty easily, if the relationship is fundamentally sound. Or what happens is that this smooths over the situation pretty well for the time being and takes the animosity out of a great deal of what's going on, but it doesn't actually get to the root of the problem, and there's still a wellspring of conflict that's coming up because somebody in that relationship doesn't qualify for somebody else. And that's actually driving the behavior that's annoying and upsetting and disturbing, and then admit it's driving the feelings of unfairness, and it's driving the anger displays and the latent threat that's under those anger displays, et cetera. So, yeah, don't take these people's advice and think nicer thoughts about what the other person's, you know, pissy behavior really might mean. Forget about it. What you want to do is you want to unpack this in this sort of way and realize that the anger isn't, quote, destructive behavior. What it actually is it's a signal and it's a frustration and it's a comment about the inference of unfairness. And we want to get to the root of that. Now, when it comes to they're sort of vaguely describing a vicious cycle, but what we want to do is be more specific. And that is, and they're trying to like mitigate it somehow. We start to mitigate the vicious cycle by spinning it very hard by flooding the circuit. When we flood the circuit, we've stopped. The really vicious part of this is the esteem hits that the person is sending with the anger. Okay? They are threatening the person. They're threatening the relationship. There can be counter threats. It's like, well, if you don't value me that much, then I'm not going to value you that much either. So what we must do is go directly against that signal and essentially use a very, very loud, explicit voice that says, I value you tremendously. And I just want to be fair, and I want to understand where you're coming from. That is the mechanism to stop the vicious cycle. Okay? So that's how we do it, and that's some good instruction for people that are listening.
So, Dr. Right. Lyle, I have a follow-up question, which is, I mean, you're obviously highly intelligent, but there's a lot of highly intelligent people all over the world, but they're all spouting a lot of the BS about, you know, stuff that we've heard here with different articles, health, human nature, mm-hmm. government, stuff like that. So this is not my question. This is a question from a listener from way back when. But the question is, what's your secret? is there some sort of perfect personality to acquiring good information? Or is it just knowledge of all the biases and statistics and then just some bit of dumb luck? Like, how do you know this stuff? And why don't they?
Right.
All?
How do I know? Why am I right and everybody else wrong?
Right. Right. Exactly.
All right. The thing is that there's probably multiple factors that have gone into this, and luck has certainly played a great role. So, so when it came to economics, I got very lucky. I was interested and I was majoring in economics, and it was confusing. And one day I happened to be in the library, and I was just looking to take a break. And I was very interested in learning economics, and that's why I was majoring in it. But it was confusing, and it all didn't integrate with a damn, quite frankly. And it looked to be sort of impossibly complicated, and I just felt like, you know, I just can't believe that I would ever actually integrate and thoroughly understand the dynamics that would be, you know, in Samuelson's major text on economics. It just wasn't coming together, even though I was getting an A in class. And so I went to the little section, and there was a book there. It was actually a paperback book that had a cheap library binding over it. It was called You Can Profit from a Monetary Crisis. And I knew of the author. It was Harry Brown. And I knew of him. He was touted by people that I had confidence in. And I sat down to read the book, and it was extremely readable. And within 100 pages of reading You Can Profit from a Monetary Crisis, I understood economics. It's like I was done. And I was done with my econ major. I was done with my professors. Clearly, they didn't grasp this in this way. And so what I got was really good teaching. And then that was a major backdrop of thinking that hasn't left me to this day. When I was interested in psychology, I spent I had a really good what you call a classical education in psychology. So I was learning all the things that, you know, major university PhD students are learning about psychology and clinical psychology the way we're dutifully supposed to do it. So I was getting a really good grounding for 10 years at the university level, both, you know, from my undergrad and my grad school. At the end of that time, right about when I was ending this, I'll tell the story. I don't know if I've told it before, but never on the radio like this. So now the whole world's going to know the story if I haven't told it before. When I was married, my wife was a grad student along with me at the University of Virginia, and she liked to get free crap. She just did. She was an accumulator of crap. And so the behavioral science book club that came with like the monthly little American Psychologist newspaper, whatever it was that we got as grad students, that I never would have gotten, but she paid the $25 fees. So we get this crap in the house every month. And it had the equivalent of the old Columbia Records thing of, buy 3 records this year and you get 8 records free for 1 cent. Okay. Well, I had done that as an undergrad and regretted it. And because they'll send you these cards, and if you don't send the card back, then they'll send the record, and then you've got some, you know, album you don't want. So anyway, the same thing happened. She wanted to join this thing, and I said, don't do it. Don't do it. These cards are going to come in, and then we're going to get some book that they're going to ship it to us because you forgot to send the card back. And then we're going to have to either buy it but she wanted all the free crap. It's like $366 free books and supplies, you know, with a psychology thesaurus and the DSM-3 and everything else under the sun. So she wanted to do this, and I said, okay, I mean, what am I going to say? Cool, go ahead, but stay on top of those stupid cards. Well, she didn't. We were living apart because I was doing my internship in Maryland. And I came home, and sure enough, there was a book there. It's like, oh, for crying out loud, you didn't send the card back. She's like, oh, I know, I got busy, I just lost the card. I'm like, great. So it was at least a skinny book. You know, these books are way overpriced because they're going to try to fleece you on the 3 books that you have to buy that year. Well, it was a selfish gene. And so I thought, I remember it was $19.97 when if you'd buy it in the store at that point, it would have been $12.95. I'm like, okay, well, whatever. So I thought, well, we got to buy three of these things anyway. So, you know, it's like a Christmas present. So I opened it up and I read the first paragraph and that was it. Like, oh my God. And by the end of page two, I knew that I had just learned something that no psychologist at the University of Virginia knew. That the purpose of animal behavior is to survive and reproduce, to pass on the genes. It was just, it was a thunderbolt. So this was luck. I could have easily gone through my life and never gotten this message. I could have heard it from somebody that was interesting and passionate about it, but it wouldn't have been the great Dawkins with his extraordinary prose. And so I happened to get incredibly lucky, and that now 30 years later, since that time, you know, I've been able to meet and read the writings of brilliant people, and that's, you know, in the field, and they all line up on the dots because this is all consilience. It's all integrated in with the entire unity of knowledge of science. So meanwhile, our little friends here at the Journal of Personality Research are trying to publish something on anger, completely and utterly unconnected to consilience. There's no dots that go back to physics. But what we think about here and what we discuss here goes back to physics. Physics determines chemistry. Chemistry determines biology. Biology determines psychology. Psychology determines sociology, political science, and anthropology. That's how it works. Okay? This is all a network of laws of the way nature works. And so that's why I'm right a lot. I'm right a lot because my thinking is guided by the principles of consilience. And a lot of that, obviously, it helps to be bright. And it also helps to be well-educated enough to know that the great authorities in the world don't know. Okay, so somebody else that might have heard about the selfish gene or even read a couple of chapters wouldn't have appreciated that the entire field of psychology was in the dark, but I did because I was right in the middle of a top university finishing up my PhD. So if I hadn't heard this message, then that means the profs didn't know, and if the profs didn't know, the whole field didn't know. If the whole field didn't know, this was a revolution, in which it is. And so this is... So the answer to the question is I was lucky. I found gold. I would also say something else, which is what Sir Francis Crick said when people said, you guys found gold. He says, yeah, but we were looking for gold. And I was too. Okay, so I was determined to try to understand how psychology works, and I did not buy into any of the major theories. I was frustrated that there was not an integrated way of thinking about the field, and I was frustrated that there didn't seem to be a plumb line to guide our thinking, and I was frustrated about it. And all the other little clinicians are lining up either psychodynamic or cognitive behavioral. You're supposed to vote for one of the teams, and that's supposed to tell you something about who you are. And I didn't vote for any team because it just didn't make sense to me. Nobody had an integrated view. When Dawkins, by page two of The Selfish Gene, I knew that and instantly understood that an integrated view of understanding psychology was possible. I had no idea how far that this would take us clinically. I couldn't have speculated. But it turns out, of course, that when you finally have a place to set your lever, you can move the world. And the rest of psychology has not set its lever down. And so they continue to be bright people doing investigations unconnected to consilience and therefore not having their thinking guided by an integrated theory to help them. And that's why I'm right and everybody else is wrong.
The follow-up question for you that I've wondered for a while is, if you had your way and you could snap your fingers and create a research project to demonstrate a particular effect, would – you know, what would it be? And have you thought about something like that?
Well,
not
actually,
to actually do it,
No, I haven't thought about it, but John Tubing and Lita Cosmides did think about this. they had an extraordinary vision for psychology that I did not actually understand until I met them, which I met them last summer. And I got to sit there next to Lita Cosmides and talk to her for 5 hours. And I'm bragging. This is name dropping here. This is like I met Elvis. Okay. So I met Elvis, everybody. So I met Elvis, and Elvis, you know, can really sing. Lita Cosmides really is as smart as it looks. And she and John Tubi actually, even in their, you know, 30th year as they're getting their PhDs, they know that they understand the revolution, and they know they're at Harvard University, and they know that the rest of the world doesn't know it, including the Harvard faculty. And so they sit there and they grind on the problem, and they actually come up with a plan to try to revolutionize the field by educating all the poor saps that don't understand. And what they did was that they went into each area of psychology that's remotely connected to them, and they looked for the biggest, baddest theories that carry the big weight that everybody believes in, that are the big, you know, vanguards of thought in a given subfield, and then they chopped it to pieces. So they would look at it and say, okay, they're wrong there, but everybody thinks they're right. And so we are going to do a research study to demonstrate that they're wrong, and we're going to show everybody that the way you arrive at the correct solution is through evolutionary lens, and this is why they made their mistake. It's incredible. And in other words, they're trying to be as efficient as possible at changing the course of the Titanic. And they haven't been very successful, and they're frustrated with that lack of success. But they've been – so in one way, in other words, so your question is, what research project would you do? Well, Tubi and Cosmides have done a bunch of them, and they went to considerable effort to try to throw a rock through the biggest windows in town. And I have to tell you, they've thrown some big rocks or some big windows, but it wasn't by accident. They did it for this reason. They have not – you know, we couldn't analyze – what their impact has been. The impact will grow and will eventually transform the entire field in the next 50 or 100 years. But they're frustrated that it didn't, in the 30, 35 years they've been at it, they haven't been more successful. Now, in my view, they have been spectacularly successful because they've educated probably, you know, 1,000 academics around the world that understand in a way that they never would have understood. So, so the seeds are sown, but this is kind of this is like a Copernican revolution. You know, the peasants and even the monks and the, you know, and even the intelligentsia are not going to grasp it for a while, and it might easily take 100 years before this becomes common knowledge and the baseline of how psychology is viewed.
Just absolutely fascinating.
Long answer to the question is dumb, mostly dumb luck and a few brains. That's more or less what it was. All right.
Well, we're going to turn the ship a little bit and talk about another form of love, another form of luck, which is, in this case, in this person's question, it's about unrequited love. Mm-hmm. So, Dr. Lyle, about a year ago, I moved to a Buddhist monastery where I lived for 3 months. While I was there, I fell in love with one of the monks. He's my age, and we have similar passions, and we shared a connection. But as much as I try, I cannot seem to let go of this infatuation. I feel like he's my soulmate, even though, red flag, he's a celibate monk. I'm a classical singer, and he does not like classical music, so I know it would never work. But we're both vegan, have a good sense of humor, very smart, have intense personalities. When will I be able to let go of this crush? We stayed in contact after I left the monastery, but I have stopped regular communication. He knows how I feel, because he asked me if I had feelings for him, and my impression is that it boosts his ego to think that I like him. Am I crazy for holding out hope that he might feel the same way, even though he has not given me any clear indication that he does?
Oh, if you live long enough, you'll hear it all. Oh my goodness. Falling in love with a Buddhist monk. The guy's there for a reason, okay? So the and it's you know, I get it. I mean, I can understand how something like this could happen. There could be many, many factors driving it, but obviously, whatever's going on with this situation, the woman does not qualify. Okay? So this is and there may be a number of reasons why she doesn't qualify. In other words, nobody may qualify because we don't know anything about this guy's psychology. He may be a very odd dude in a number of ways. And this, for all we know, he's gay. For all we know, he's transgender. For all we know, he's got some really weird stuff up there. We have no clue. He may have pedophilic fantasies, and this is why he's become a Buddhist monk. Or he just may want to be a Buddhist monk because he thinks it's cool and it, you know, it has some benefits to it. And he would fall in love with somebody else, but our girl doesn't qualify. So if you're kind of bat your eyelashes at somebody for 3 months and make a little kissy face and talk about all your deep soul connection, and the guy, you know, doesn't flirt with you at all, doesn't make the slightest move, doesn't make any indication that there's any possibility you're interested in something in a relationship, you don't qualify. Okay? Now, you may be maintaining that interest for a number of reasons, because he doesn't, you know, he may be kind and interested in you as a person. We could have a weak knees delta situation where, you know, he would be a beautiful, over-rewarding person, and there he is single right there, and he's a really nice guy, and he's handsome, and I'm attracted to him, and oh my God. It's like, yeah, too bad. If you don't qualify, you don't qualify. So you don't qualify. That's the fundamental reason. You're probably not getting over it because the guy is such a gentle soul that he's not giving you any rejecting feedback and not actually signaling any irritation when you give him positive feedback. In fact, it may even boost his ego. He may like it. He may like the positive feedback, but that's it. He's not interested in giving you any positive feedback. So send him a postcard now and then, and maybe whatever, you know, by email or by handwritten postcard from, who knows, the Netherlands, and say hello, you know, whatever. And for all we know, some wacky thing that is in his head that's making him a Buddhist monk may get somehow resolved. Not likely. Move on. This is a waste of time in search of a romantic relationship, but it may not be a waste of time in terms of something warm and friendly that you have some degree of contact into your future. So that's how you look at it. You'll move on when you invest a little bit of time and energy and maybe finding somebody new. And then suddenly you get some positive feedback, and you're like, oh, that's how it's supposed to be. And that is how it's supposed to be.
Dr. Lau, would you ever join a Buddhist monastery for a couple of months as long as they had a basketball court there?
Yeah, I might for a couple of months. If they have a basketball court, I'd get away. No phone calls. I could just work on my new shot technique, which is really exciting, by the
Well,
way.
you'll have to tell us all
Well,
about it on a
that,
different
hold on.
show.
Yeah. Well, Alan Goldhammer and I discovered a new shot technique at our old man's basketball camp from a great coach. And so now we're just gloating, and we can't wait to get to the gym every day. And quite frankly, we don't even want to work. Just want to go work on our shot. So
Well,
that's what's going on with us.
I hear that the
Yeah.
Tuscany Hotel, which is the site of Chef AJ's ultimate weight loss program, I believe they have a basketball court there. So maybe you'll be
Oh.
able to play.
Oh my God. We'll have a vegan demonstration
Yeah.
of vegan basketball players at 60 years old showing how it's done. Yeah, I can't wait. Chef AJ, we're looking forward to that, Chef AJ. We'll make sure there's a hoop around there somewhere.
Oh,
All
yeah. And
right.
speaking of which, so Chef AJ's Ultimate Weight Loss Program is happening in Labor Day weekend. And so if you register, you could get to register by February 1st. You can save $300 for that. And you get to meet Dr. Lyle, Dr. Goldhammer in person, Chef AJ, Jean Pierre, Neil Barnard. I think there's one other person here. It's Dr. Thomas Campbell. the medical director of the T. Colin Campbell Center for Nutrition Studies. So check that out. I'm going to be there as well, but I'll just be on the sides. You can check it out at chefajwebsite.com. So
Tom Campbell's coming.
Looks like it. Yeah, I got a flyer here.
Tom Campbell is the second nicest person in the world. The first nice person is his dad. Is Colin. Unbelievable. That's great. It'll be great to see him. I haven't seen him in a few years. Cool.
Yeah, sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun. So,
all
right. So our question actually has to do with the Ultimate Weight Loss Program. So, and it's a dietary question. It's from somebody who says, Dr. Lyle, I'm relatively new with the Ultimate Weight Loss Program, and I've been having some success, but I'm not all in. Now, though, I'm thinking of non-compliant food for, days on end, and I feel like I'm in danger of a slip. How do I stop myself, even if I haven't been able to be all in? How do I stop myself from having these cravings? But even if I haven't been all in, it's worlds better than it was before.
Yeah. What you're dealing with is pressure that comes from two different sides of your motivation. And so this is a very interesting problem. This is what we're going to call the pleasure trap on one side and the ego trap on the other. So just in case your issue about being all in, I'm not all in. Okay. So I've lived just fine not being all in on healthy diet. I'm pretty much in, and I do a good job, but I'm not looking to be perfect. Perfection is ideal for reducing cravings over time, because if you do a superb job for about 4 months, then you will pretty well not have any interest at all in any naughty food. You just won't. This is what I call a deep groove, where the palate is so sensitized that that you really would not, you have no interest in going outside of the matrix. The problem is it's difficult to get in a deep groove, and even once you're there, even though you could be pretty well bunkered in for a while, sooner or later you may get pushed out of it. Now, certain personalities won't get pushed out of it. So if you're Chef AJ, you're not going to get pushed out of it. If you're Alan Goldhammer, you're not going to get pushed out of it. But if you're me, if you're weak of the flesh.
Me too.
you're going to get pushed out of it, okay? And so the problem is that if you have conceptually set the bar very high, and the concept is that you're supposed to be perfect, then when you quote transgress, you may essentially feel like some sort of a failure, and you may be embarrassed, and you may feel like you've discovered that you cannot, in fact, keep up perfect behavior, and yet you may feel like you should be able to keep up perfect behavior because some of these icons do. And so as a result, you've walked into what we call the ego trap, where the expectations are too high. And so what happens when we're in the ego trap, we very likely then kick over the table and just essentially self-destruct and just say, we basically are showing our internal audience, you can't judge me because I'm not trying. Okay? And this is very common in drug and alcohol problems. So the expectation is that you're going to be perfect. Then if you aren't perfect, you've been perfect for a while, you might have been sober for 90 days, and then you crack, and then you don't, you have two things now chasing you. You have the pleasure trap that is now chasing you, but now the ego trap has got you in a situation where you are embarrassed, and now the right thing to do is to deliberately self-destruct so that you can show your internal audience and anybody else, you can't judge my ability to manage this problem because I'm not really trying. Watch me while I take another drink. So our problem is that if you set the bar so low that you basically say, oh, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to add a carrot a week, or I'm going to add an apple a day to my normal diet. If we set the bar so low that we're going to be out of the ego trap, but we're going to be in the pleasure trap because we're going to still be eating ham and cheese sandwiches and barbecue and chocolate shakes. so we will never sensitize the palate around a healthy diet. On the other hand, if we set the bar so high at perfection, then we can walk our way into the ego trap, and when we stumble, we're going to kick over the table and be in trouble. So the right way to do this is to understand that we're conceptually aiming for somewhere in the middle. And I just was talking to a lady this week on the phone about this, that she's bouncing around and not kind of knowing how to manage this. And I said, here's one, you know, every nervous system is going to be different, so I can't give you a hard and fast rule. But here's something that we can try. And that is that we can try that once a week when you go out, you know, if you wanted to go out and have a glass of wine and have, you know, a piece of pizza. It's like, okay, let's make it a once a week thing because it's a social issue for her. And then in this case, we're gonna say, okay, listen, we're gonna get some turbulence in the pleasure trap the next day to some degree. We're gonna be thinking about the pizza, thinking about the wine. It's gonna rattle around a little bit. However, if we can relax into the notion that, you know what, we're going to be able to do it again next Saturday because it's a Saturday night ritual, then after we do this for a while, we can get into a groove where essentially we're not that freaked out about the transgression, and we're not that excited or feeling deprived about it, you know, in the days that follow, because we know next Saturday we're going to have the same thing, that we're going to do it again. So this is one choice to set the parameters between the pleasure trap and the ego trap, that we keep it clean enough that we really like clean food, but once a week we let our hair down, okay? And for a meal, it's Sunday morning brunch, maybe that's going to be what it is, or Saturday night. Or you could, you know, it's probably, you know, I'm not going to say it's a prescription that you should do at the same meal every week, but it's not a bad idea for a while. In other words, just set up a ritual. So this is one style. Other people could do it very differently. Depends upon who the person is. There's people that could transgress to the tune of 200 or 300 naughty calories a day and do the rest of their calories really good, and they'd be fine. Okay, I think a lot of people do that. So when it comes to healthy living and healthy eating, most of the value that has taken place as a result of these discoveries has taken place in the bodies of people who have not done it perfectly. So keep that in mind. The fact that there are some people out there who are exemplary and have unusual personalities and somewhat unusual circumstances, I mean, that's remarkable and it's admirable, but it's not something that you need to emulate. What we want to do instead is to set a course for a combination that works for you. And we can see that over time. If you're doing well, you're healthy, you're reasonably fit, and you like to eat healthy food most of the time, we've done well. And that's all we need to do.
Fantastic, Dr. Lyle. As always, we love it. And we will look forward to talking to you more next week with some more questions. We had a caller on hold, but it looks like the caller hung up. So, caller, if this wasn't the right time, call back next week. We'll take your question. We've got some questions coming up next week. And then we've got an episode on the ego trap in the works here in a couple of weeks. So stay tuned for that. Dr. Lyle, okay. We will look forward to chatting with you next week. And good luck in the storm. Hopefully it doesn't knock out any more power.
Okay. Very good. All right, folks. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.